Hello and welcome back to Season 5 of Open with me, Emma Campbell, the podcast where connection happens through open-hearted conversations. There is such power in sharing our stories and allowing ourselves to be held and heard as we navigate life and its many chapters. So join me as I talk to a special guest each week in a way that aims to delve a little deeper. Uplifting insights, wisdom, takeaway nuggets that remind us of our own resilience, our limitless potential, and crucially, that the more we open up to each other, the more connected we feel. This week's episode of Open is sponsored by Owning Your Menopause, currently the only app offering daily live and on-demand workouts 365 days a year for women going through the menopause. Founded by menopause coach and author of Fitter, Calmer, Stronger in 30 Days, Kate Roham, the app provides support and evidence-based information which is critical for women feeling overwhelmed by menopausal symptoms. I've got a fantastic offer to share with you. 25% off an annual subscription to the app with a free 7-day trial, so it really is a no-brainer, even for those of us engulfed in menopausal brain fog. So download Owning Your Menopause today and use the code OPEN25 to claim your discount. And you can also check out at Owning Your Menopause on Instagram. My first guest on this new season of Open is clinical psychologist Dr. Nicole LaPera, better known to her nearly 8 million Instagram followers as the Holistic Psychologist. Her books, including How to Meet Yourself and How to Do the Work, have sold millions of copies around the world, with her most recent book, How to Be the Love You Seek, recently hitting number one on the New York Times bestsellers list. How to Be the Love You Seek is the last in her how-to trilogy, and in it, Dr. LaPera illuminates the way out of trauma bonds and interrelationships rooted in mutual respect and compassion. She teaches us how to break painful cycles and reconnect with the wisdom, appreciation, and compassion that lives in each of our hearts. To have the time with Nicole was a bit of a pinch-me moment, I've got to say, and I'm so thrilled to be able to share this fascinating and illuminating conversation with you. I hope you enjoy it. Nicole, hello, and thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so grateful.
Thank you so much, Emma, for having me. I'm honored to be here.
It's really lovely. So I'm in London, you're in the States. So for me, it's kind of early evening, for you, it's early morning. And it's just, yeah, it's an absolute privilege to have this time with you. So I've got to say, I've got to be completely honest, when I began working on this podcast, this episode is going to be in season 5, which comes out in January. You were on my vision board of dream guests. And actually earlier on today, I was trying to find the little, you know, index card that I'd kept, when you update your vision boards. And I was like, you were there literally with the card. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? So it's just lovely. A big believer in manifestation. So, we've got so much to talk about. I've got your amazing book here, How to Be the Love You Seek. And there's just so many questions, and I really want to make the most of our time. Firstly, we'll start with how you're known globally as the Holistic Psychologist with the most extraordinary social media following, currently 7.6 million followers on Instagram. Holistic psychology, would you describe that as the integration of body, mind, and soul? What's your definition of holistic psychology?
Well, first, Emma, thank you for having me a part of your vision board. I'm honored. I'm blushing. I actually have one of my many tattoos. One of them says, hold your vision. It's a reminder for me and all of us. So I just took a moment to speak that into existence. All of you out there listening, that we hold our vision. We act in accordance. I mean, you putting this work out, you know, season after season, embodying the possibility. I really want to just take a moment to honor that. So yes, to answer your question, for me, holistic work really was a shift from my traditional training and really the way I conceptually thought as a human, which for traditionally, and I think for a lot of us humans, really overemphasized the power of the mind. And of course, we have a very powerful mind that can imagine futures and hold visions and create those futures into existence. Though the other half, sending messages to our mind, really is the body. For me, that was left out of clinical training. My care, personal care in terms of being connected with my body and honoring my body's physical limits and tending to my emotions was left out of my own personal experience. So in many ways, I am the living embodiment of how important it is to understand ourselves as holistic beings, and then more so to translate that understanding into more holistic wellness that I truly believe we can all begin to create in each of our individual lives.
And what was the point of change for you, or the point of, and obviously I've read the book, so I know that you had your kind of your own, well, dark night of the soul, yes, kind of emotional rock bottom. And I think many of us can relate to those times in life where, you know, we are in the depths of darkness, but often they are a precursor to real transformation and shift, even though it doesn't feel like it at the time. So I'd love you to share a little bit about that sort of transition.
My dark night of the soul, which I very much understand is that as well, though I wouldn't have used that language knowing what was happening at the time, it happened not coincidentally for me. I had just entered my 30s and I had just also kind of checked, if you will, the final box off of my endless list of achievements that I had been driving myself forward to for decades in terms of schooling. I had just gotten to the possibility in my career to start and open what would end up being a successful private practice. I had just made the move from where I was training in New York City back to Philadelphia, which is where I'm originally from. So I was able to, you know, live in my hometown, if you will, near my family, which was something that I thought I or imagined I would want to remain forever. I was in a committed relationship. And yet I felt I would fantasize. I think about this often. I relive it with my partner, Lolly, who was with me. Through those years, I would fantasize about running away in so many ways. I felt really low, really disconnected from the life that I was trudging through, you know, Monday to Friday, just trying to kind of get through, and really unfulfilled and not knowing what was happening and externally being as successful as I knew I appeared to be to so many of those around me and to society really at large. I shamed myself. I wouldn't have understood that what was happening for me was the result of living in a very conditioned way in which I was disconnected from my physical bodies and overstepping my limits. I was suppressing my emotions, living, as I say in my first book, How to Do the Work, in a spaceship. I wasn't showing up authentically in any of my relationships. And without that language, I spent a lot of time, you know, feeling shameful that I was feeling as I did. Though, as my dad likes to still joke to this day, the endless learner in me, he would always joke when I was going to year upon year of schooling, are you ever going to stop learning? And interestingly enough, in many ways, the answer is no, I will never stop learning. I did, I think, what a lot of us do. I went online because I was seeing a similar pattern at that point in the, not just in my own life and with all my friends who seemingly were fantasizing for the weekend, you know, not really liking the life that they were living. I saw a continued pattern of disempowerment in the clients that I was working with, where it seemed to me no amount of insight awareness, we could have the most incredibly successful feeling session, yet that client would come in the next week and report the same habits and patterns that they were trying to break in their own life. So I went online and I did some learning. And for me, it opened up such possibility that translated to individual transformation when I began to learn about the body, our nervous system in particular, gut health and the important role that that plays in terms of our mental wellness. When I really began to understand the power of our subconscious mind, all of the reasons why many of us are repeating patterns keeping us stuck. And when I began to apply new choices in my own life to begin to create change was really then the moment where I knew intuitively that I wanted to begin to understand human suffering in a more holistic manner, because I truly believe there is an underlying cause physiologically or emotionally with the symptoms we're experiencing or the patterns or cycles, as this new book, the subtitle suggests, the cycles we can't break. And I began to now see a pathway of action working with the human individual holistically and then ultimately, as I do now, in community with others.
And as a result of your own kind of that very, very challenging time, you know, with your years of training and your expertise, still you are experiencing the same disconnect as like you say, as your clients. And I think, and as the people that you were serving and working with, and as someone who's only just tapping into that holistic idea of, you know, the somatic, you know, the way the body holds trauma and really starting to just delve into that for the very first time. Exactly like your father said as you were growing up and continues to say, you feel like actually once you open that kind of box of learning and insight and you go on that journey of self-awareness and self-discovery, the layers just keep peeling back. And that's often very uncomfortable. But ultimately, I feel, and which I think I speak for so many, and which is why so many of us resonate with your work, it's the tip of the iceberg. But once you start, you can't really stop. But it changes everything in the most sort of illuminating way. And, you know, and the words, the language that we're also familiar with now. So, you know, trauma bonds, core wounds, the inner child. And we hear those kind of, they're almost like hashtags, aren't they? But actually, again, when you really start to understand it and the pennies drop, I kind of find myself getting goosebumps a lot as I think I'm just beginning the work now at this point in my life, in my early 50s. I'm just really understanding, you know, why I am, why my life has unfolded and relationships have unfolded in the way they have. So, I mean, the book, like I said, it covers so much. So the trauma bonds, the conditioned selves, harnessing the wisdom of the body and the power of the heart. And we are understanding there are so many conversations about neuroplasticity and the fact that actually our brains are capable of change and able to be rewired if we do the work. So where do we begin? For those of us, you know, we all know that kind of awareness is the first step, you know, well, at least you're aware of it, but then what? For the average, in inverted commas, person who, without the years of right. You know, what is the next step once you have that awareness?
For me, it's even hearing you kind of cite, as is the case, the global nature of some of these terms, inner child, you know, trauma bonding and all that, you know, I'm talking about. For me, it's so hopeful because it does signify an increasing awareness. And I celebrate any individual wherever they are in terms of their, you know, age, their biological age, if you will, because having that awareness, to speak to your question really, is the first step. Until I become truly present to the habits and patterns that are creating my current reality, for the sake of this conversation around this new book, my relational reality, most of which the habits and patterns that were created in my first reality, my first relationships, my first environment, where I had adapted in whatever way I needed to, each of us, you know, living in unique circumstances to maintain the relationships and connections where I ingrained or embedded some beliefs about myself, some habited ways that I tend to my emotions or suppress my emotions, the things that I feel safe showing other people about myself in terms of self-expression and relationships, the things that I don't feel safe or I feel shameful about, all of that is so driven by those subconscious habits. So while absolutely no change, or what I would call the second step being no new choice, can happen without that awareness, the reality of it is twofold. First and foremost, having that awareness at whatever age it is that it happens is incredibly difficult. There's a reason why we've adapted and many of us have stayed, as I say, a spaceship away, a million miles away from my emotions, or have worried more about caring for others because at some time that was the way we were able to secure our connections in childhood and haven't looked at ourselves at all. So not only have those habit patterns been a protection, so when we do become present, it is incredibly uncomfortable. And I think so many of us think, well, intuitively, healing means just feeling better when I have this awareness. Absolutely not. The embodied action of being present to some very difficult circumstances, some very overwhelming emotions, some even grief, all of the ways that we felt we had to show up and all of the aspects of our true being that we've suppressed, all of the needs that we haven't had met, is incredibly difficult. And then to answer your question, the next step is making those new choices. And while the mind and body, we now know, thankfully, is neuroplastic and can change no matter at what age you're coming to this awareness and beginning to make those consistent new choices, our nervous system, and this is why so many of my clients and myself have been stuck, prefer those habitual reactions. Even with glaring, overwhelming consequences that we want to avoid, and we've spent a lifetime repeating, it will still feel safer. We'll have a false sense of control simply because we can predict what happened and our body knows more or less what it's going to do next. And in the uncertainty that might come after this new choice might be something even more overwhelming. So we gravitate. So saying that to say insight, and this is what I would say in those clients I was working with, isn't enough. We have to teach our mind and body how to tolerate. Many of us as adults have very limited or kind of small windows, as we say in the field, of tolerance for stress, for upsetting emotion, driving us right back into those old familiar habits and patterns. So the work really is holistically building into our bodies the ability to change.
Yeah. And even if you look at the, you know, it's an obvious thing to say, but the physical embodiment of grief, that feeling of almost like a fetal kind of, you know, the physical pain, you know, and you talk so beautifully about the heart and the kind of, you know, the energy field around the heart. I mean, there's so much, you know, the heart, brain coherence, but I think it's true. I think sitting with discomfort for so many of us is just too uncomfortable. Right. Therefore, we gravitate towards. And I think when life presents you with something, a situation where you have no choice but to sit with the discomfort, maybe that's where these kind of cliches of, you know, emerging from the ashes, or, you know, blossoming after some kind of tragedy comes from, when we've had no choice but to sit with in the worst, darkest moments. That's when the change. But because for many of us, if I think of, you know, there are many people who've had a significant trauma in their early years, you know, whether for many, many reasons, obviously, whether that be an absent parent or growing up in some kind of abusive environment or whatever it might be. But for many of us, there might not be one thing that's kind of the pivotal moment, age six, that then explains our adult behavior. So, you know, those kind of, there are so many of us who are living in this fight or flight dysregulated state, even if we can't exactly pinpoint, you know, why. And it really is, isn't it, as subtle as kind of the facial expressions of our family members, or the energy when we walk into a room. But it's incredible how that can just permeate through and really define who we are and how we then step into the world. You know,
for me, what was really difficult, and I had to expand even my definition of the concept of trauma, of what could happen that could cause impact. Because when I looked back, you know, or what I knew about my immediate family environment, was that I didn't have any absent parents. I actually had my mother, who was always home in care of myself and my siblings. And until I really understood, even as a clinical psychologist, we were not given, in my opinion, at that time, I'm hoping things have changed, the adequate training to understand how important emotional attunement is. Because while my mom was physically present, she was, because of her own past experience, what she was not only modeled in her home, what she experienced in her home, being completely overwhelmed and under-supported emotionally, she, just like I ended up being, was a million miles away in, again, her own spaceship. So she wasn't able to be emotionally attuned to me. And then what that did holistically to my nervous system, bringing in, right, the very universal fight or flight, even a fawn response is people-pleasing, hypervigilant mode, or a freeze and a shutdown response. That's where I lived most of my life. Frozen, waiting for the next shoe to drop, having panic attacks. That's emblematic of a freeze response. And then ultimately, away in my spaceship, the shutdown. Universally, when things don't feel safe, again, because maybe a family member isn't physically present, there is violation or physical or sexual abuse, or like me, there was an emotional absence, as developing nervous systems, quite literally, because our nervous system is developing up until our 20s and dependent developing humans, we will be so consistently overwhelmed by our own stress of living without someone to help us co-regulate with, or stress of unmet needs, or stress of active violations that have happened, that our nervous system will have no choice but to begin to initiate those responses. And then what happens in this kind of choreographed dance, we're always making sense of the world, even as we're young and developing. So now we're trying to understand what's happening, and we're beginning to assign personalized meanings to our caregivers' inconsistent care of us, or abuse and violation of us. We're beginning to then continue to use those same meanings to filter our current experiences, the world around us. And then with our mind and body in communication, we continue to repeat the exact same patterns of nervous system activation, triggered or activated, living in my body, then activated by the narrative that my mind assigns, and then volleying back and forth, we can't come out of that stress response until, of course, we begin to teach our bodies how. So for me, again, over opening up my mind to that, I did, and I was living in chronic nervous system dysregulation, and this was impacting how I was viewing the world and showing up in my relationships, allowed me to begin to regulate my nervous system in adulthood.
And actually, when you explain it like that, you realize how illogical it is to think that we can do that from the neck up.
Right.
If you know what I mean, you know, that idea that it all just all change happens up here, but actually, no, it's a complete head to toe sort of experience. So the idea that all our actions and choices stem from those core wounds and wanting our needs to be met, is that something that through this work we can, like you say, we can begin to make those different choices, and we're making those choices not based on the familiar past, not based on the, you know, as Joe Dispenza would say, who, you know, that kind of idea of the familiar past, and mm-hmm. actually standing in a more rooted, centered way and making more mindful choices. I mean, you also, something that you talked about in the book is the realization that you had that the sort of kind, compassion, these are your words, the kind, compassionate person that you thought you were, or how you presented, actually maybe that came under kind of some kind of question as you weren't connected to your heart. And it made me think about my relationship with the word connection, which is a word that I use all the time. I sort of, if people say, well, you know, connection, that's the first word that sort of comes out of my mouth when I think of this podcast, the kind of, you know, open-hearted, conversations leading to connection, all of that, connection through open-hearted conversations. But it made me think, gosh, recently I kind of thought, I talk so much about the word connection. How connected am I to myself? Maybe I have this desire to talk endlessly about the importance of connection because actually, come on, Em, how can it? So that, it was really interesting to, again, to read your kind of comparison of maybe that idea we have, or that yearning, you know, I'm compassionate, I'm kind, or I'm connected. Well, what about how we show up for ourselves? And self-abandonment is another whole kind of topic mm-hmm. I'm just beginning to tap into as well. How easily we jump ship on ourselves.
I love, Emma, because intuitively these concepts and the question of needs and how that leads, or unmet needs, how those, that leads to connection or disconnection from our heart, and ultimately connection or disconnection from our ability to be compassionate and loving and in care of another. And for me, learning that all of that is built in the foundation of creating space in my life as an individual, in my relational life, where for me, for decades, it was incredibly difficult to create space for myself, someone who has physical needs, emotions resulting in the emotional need that we all share as universal humans for support, right? To feel connected in whatever emotion it is that we're having. And what I had seen as a pattern that I had developed, again, early on in childhood, where I had learned that I had two learnings that really impacted my ability and resulted in disconnection for me. I had a kind of learning that my mom was emotionally unavailable, as I shared earlier, unless I was achieving something, producing something, doing something. At the same time, there was so much stress consistently in my home. I grew up in a city, so there was the unnatural stress of living in a city that I don't think humans are wired to live in, with crime and things that actually, you know, happened in my family home, my family car, sirens outside. There was the stress of growing up in a family where there was chronic health issues. And so while nothing was necessarily, except things to worry about on the outside, nothing was talked about in terms of how to join together and support each other through stress. Implicitly, I felt, like you were talking about earlier, we just feel energies, the amount of stress, overwhelming stress in the home. And in absence of my mom's ability to emotionally support me, I developed, right, this idea that it was important for me to continue to succeed and not to be an emotional burden in my relationships. And then I continued to repeat that which meant to me, emotional burden got translated to not to upset anyone, not to do something that's in opposition to what someone else wants or needs. I turned into the very typical people pleaser that I think many of us can relate to, where I more or less, right, I squashed, disconnected from all of my physical needs. Well, what do you want to eat for dinner? I don't know. What do you want to eat? Not even checking in to decide what my body might want to eat for dinner, just defer to someone else. Emotionally suppressed anything I might feel or say in self-expression that might upset someone else. And what I'd come to realize, priding myself on someone who I believe, and I love how it kind of, I think in many ways, my drive, one of my number one desires always in a relationship is for my language to be considerate and compassionate toward others. And what I mean is emotionally considerate, to worry, to give them the sense that I care and I know about them and their needs and I care about them. And I do truly believe that was born out of the experience I did not have, the desire, right, for me to kind of produce something that I wasn't naturally given in that first relationship. So seemingly, I think that this people pleasing is the selflessness, the selfless way of being, right? In a sense, I have this idea, it's serving and being compassionate and of service to those around me and being loving even. I did not realize that unless I'm meeting my own needs. And when our needs are unmet, we're in what I call a version of that nervous system state of activation. We're in a survival mode. When we're not meeting our body's basic physical needs for movement, for rest, for restorative sleep at night, for oxygen, for water, right? Breath that just naturally goes through our lungs, for nutrients in the food that we eat. When we're not meeting those, or when we're emotionally overwhelmed and under-supported, we're in a survival-based mode of our brain. And in that survival mode, physiologically, we can't expand our focus to care about someone else. Even if it's our child, even if it's our romantic partner, even if it's our parent that we very much want to show up in service of. So the many of us that are living, myself included, are thinking we're being selfless by neglecting, as you said, or betraying our wants and our needs. In reality, what I'd come to find, what I was doing, locked in survival mode, I was trying to manage perception, to maintain connections, but I was doing so in an inauthentic way that I wasn't truly being of service to those or compassionate or loving to those that I desperately wanted to be.
Because it comes from a place of kind of shape-shifting, grasping, clinging, kind of chasing, you know, literally kind of climbing outside of ourselves to kind of adjust ourselves around someone else. And I'm this idea of, I mean, the self-abandonment idea has something that I've been working on, you know, as a result of the therapy that I've been having over the last couple of years. And I hadn't really heard that term before. But, and one of the sort of another little light bulb that I've had recently, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, is the idea that, you know, I've struggled hugely with rejection, you know, in a certain situation. And as I moved through that pain, the feeling was that the feeling of sort of brokenness made me feel that I would never be able to allow myself to be vulnerable again for the risk of being hurt. But then as I've sort of worked deeply on myself and really committed to attempting to look at things differently and making choices and unravel all of my conditioning, I kind of had the epiphany that if I am, and it can sound corny, but if I'm truly rooted or begin to commit to self-love, you know, to being the love that I seek, and don't abandon myself as I have done for most of my life, then actually it's impossible for me to be rejected by someone else. And I kind of, it was only a few days ago, and I had this, am I right with, I kind of, it just felt like a big neon sign above me. Like, I can't be rejected if I'm not rejecting myself. I kind of am running with that at the moment. And it's giving me such a feeling of a lovely center, not knowing what lies ahead, you know, in life, in terms of other intimate relationships or whatever. But it was just like, oh, that's really helped me. It's really helped.
What a wise insight, Emma. And when we, right, in childhood, don't feel fully, we don't have the space or the curiosity and attuned caregiver who wants to get to know us and as a separate, unique individual, we don't have the space and safety and security to then express our perspectives, our emotions, our natural way of being, when we're rejected in that way, especially in that core relationship on which we're wholly dependent, just quickly on rejection and the science of it, because we're social creatures, we've quite literally evolved in community with others, gaining a sense of physical safety, gaining a sense of emotional safety and support. Rejection in the brain, social exclusion, loneliness, any version of not belonging activates the physical pain pathway of our brain. We feel it. We feel the physical pain of not belonging. So that is real. And I want to honor all of us in all of the different ways that we felt we've been rejected, or we felt aspects of ourself are rejected. When that happens in childhood, and we're anywhere from birth till about age 7 or 8, we're in what is called, our brain is constantly developing. So with it, our cognitive abilities, if you will. And in that early developmental period, we're in what is called an egocentric stage of development, which simply means the world revolves around me. All of those meanings that I'm trying to make sense of the world and assigning to what's happening, all roads, when that caregiver isn't physically present, they physically rejected me, left, abandoned me, emotionally rejected me, as I had, was the case. The only way my childhood brain will be able to make sense of it is it must be something about me. There's something inherently unworthy or unlovable, then we'll try to attune to or seek cues to what that might be. Some of us get directly told, you're too dramatic, stop crying, toughen up, you're being too much or too little, or whatever it is. Sometimes it's indirect, right? Caregivers move away from us, distance when we're exhibiting certain characteristics or behaviors or emotions, and maybe like may celebrate when we're achieving. And that's where, grounded in this deep-rooted belief that the only thing that makes me worthy is showing up, we will desperately try to maintain those connections. What we'll then carry with us in life is that deep-rooted belief. And what that translates to in many of us, and kind of to now touch on your insight, I'm not worthy unless I, translates into all these conditioned ways of being. And for a lot of us, when we don't feel worthy inherently, we treat ourselves unworthy. We disconnect from our needs and we continue to engage in self-betrayal or self-neglect or self-abandonment. And we're continuing then to validate this idea that this self that I am, physical and emotional, is not worthy because I'm not showing up in action of caring for myself day in and day out. And so this idea, and even this book, I would get asked a lot when I started to talk about, oh, I'm coming out with a relationship book. People would say, well, is this only for people in relationship? And this, tying this together, we are all in relationship. Even if we're not in any committed friendship, partnership, we don't have contact with our family, the primary relationship that we're in day in and day out is with ourselves. So my answer then was wholeheartedly, and I think this weaves into this idea, right, of if I show up in service of me and my needs, I can never be abandoned or rejected. Same thing. If I show up in daily gestures of worthiness through self-care, which doesn't just include all of the fun stuff and pamper, it includes being with all of the deep, dark emotions that I've shunned or aspects of my being that I've been shameful of.
The internal
dialogue. None of us can ever be alone.
The Owning Your Menopause app aims to empower, support, and educate women to better manage their menopause by making achievable and sustainable tweaks to their diet and exercise. With an array of fitness classes to choose from, access to specialist menopause GPs, and nutritional support, the app will help you thrive through what can be an unsettling phase of life. Download the app today and use the code OPEN25 for 25% off an annual subscription with a free 7-day trial. Now, back to the show. I think, and it makes me emotional, just this part of our chat, because I kind of feel enormously grateful that I'm having these realizations, knowing that, as I say endlessly, there's no arrival point and the realizations will keep coming, and the bumps and the challenges, but the sort of almost, God, what if I hadn't, you know, I'm so grateful that I at least have got something to work with going forward. So thank you for your thoughts on that, because it really was one of those, it was almost like a bit of an otherworldly kind of you know, it dropped in. It was like a, yes, you know, a download almost, yeah, of wisdom and insight. Because, you know, when you're doing this work, as we know, you know, as the professional, the kind of processing happens between the sessions and when you've put the book down, or when you're, you know, that part of our brain is still whirring away. And you talk about the power of the heart in the book, and you I love the way you describe, you write in the book about listening to the ping of our hearts and dropping into our hearts. And for that, you know, how do we begin to look at that and commit to living our lives and making choices from our heart center? So can you, you know, very, very sort of simple terms for those who might not have heard that way of, be familiar with that way of thinking, how would you describe that ping of the heart?
I love, Emma, that you're asking this question on the heels of sharing this insightful moment, because you've given an example of this thing dropping in, this download, right? Maybe language that some of the listeners have been familiar with, in my opinion, is a version of an intuitive awareness, a ping of the heart, something that's coming in, an insightful moment seemingly out of nowhere. And I'm emphasizing this in particular, not only to use it as an illustration, to honor the work you've done to create in yourself the ability to be still enough, because we can't have a moment of stillness and have a new insight or new awareness if we're locked in survival mode, because the messages that our body will be sending our brain through the tension in our muscles, through the quickened heart rate, elevated breath, are it's unsafe. Get your butt moving, get up. This is why for me in my 20s, when I met the concept of mindfulness, right? And I had this traditional idea that being conscious was this meditative thing where I had to close my eyes, and I ran away from it because I couldn't sit still. I felt I was crawling out of my skin. My mind would race with overwhelming thoughts. I just feel too uncomfortable. And so the moments of creating the possibility begin with creating regulation, and didn't happen for me until decades later, when I taught my body how to release the tension and slow my breath and slow my heart and be able to be in stillness. Because when we're in that survival mode, we're not going to have new insights and awareness. We're not going to, some of us might not even be in our physical bodies. You might be like me, a million miles away in your spaceship, to be able to tune inward to these messages, to have a new thought or a new awareness, to incense, listen to our heart. So I love that you're asking this, because it really is this foundational, holistic journey for many of us that begins with noticing how dysregulated we are. All of the stress and trauma and overwhelm that we're carrying, many of us from generations that even came before us, and beginning that foundational commitment, tying all these together, to care for our body's physical needs. Because by doing that, we're caring for our nervous system, to teach our body, many of us well into our adulthood, because we didn't have that safe parent to co-regulate with, to help teach our body physiologically how to go from stress back into peace and calm. And then, again, I'm being very intentional here, because once we begin that journey and build that foundation, then we can get clearer on what intuition really is. When we feel at ease in our muscles, in our body, when our breath is able to be calm and deep from our belly, when our heart rate doesn't feel like it's pounding out of its chest all of the time, when we're able to embody, and it doesn't have to be in those traditional, right, 20, 30 minutes of closing my eyes, cross-leg meditations. It can be when we're going about our day and we have that new insight or that awareness pop in, or we're connected to our body and we're in conversation with someone and we feel a lightness, a tingling when they're sharing something of resonance. Or on the other side of that, we cross someone on our path and we feel a tension, a tightness, a ping of, you know, kind of something is to be avoided here. Some of us can get visualizations where just kind of images pop into our head, or phrases. These are all different examples of what intuition, how we can build the foundation to allow it in, what it could look or feel like. I do believe it's a bit different for each of us. So, you know, getting more connected to our bodies, spending time just tuning into ourselves, making space for those moments. And then the third and final step, which is often the most difficult and bravest, listening and making choices based on what your heart is saying. Because those are the moments usually where it might be going against what our conditioning is telling us, or what we should or shouldn't do in this moment, or maybe what society is telling us. that we should or shouldn't do in the moment. Or maybe what our relationships, right? These ingrained expectations that we've repeated time and time again, and now we're having this ping to show up differently. And now we're dealing with violating this person's expectation who's expecting otherwise of us. We might be coming up against some fear, some worry, some abandonment. Well, the last time I was me, this is what happened. Here it is alive in the present moment. So it's creating the safety to tune into the intuitive ping, celebrating when we're able to connect with them, and then celebrating even harder when we're able to make choices in alignment with them.
And it's just interesting how that saying of, you know, well, you know, do I go with my heart or my head? You know, that kind of, you know, like, oh, my heart. And actually, it's about bringing them both together and in that beautiful sort of cohesive way. And then, you know, and I think that's, it just popped into my head. What, I mean, I would love to also, a big part of my audience, I live with secondary breast cancer. So, you know, I'm part of an incredible community of people who have had a diagnosis. And that's been transformative, deeply healing for me in many, many ways. So for those of us who, live or have faced the diagnosis or live with, you know, and you talk about your mother and the kind of living with pain and a chronic condition of some kind. And particularly with, I'm not sure there's another word that has more of fear attached to it than cancer. So there's already, you know, there's just that, the energy around it is just impenetrable. How do we, and I've come a long way, you know, I'm nearly 14 years on. So I've come enormous, you know, proud of the strides I've made in terms of having gone from someone crippled with fear to kind of managing it and just slowly gathering my tools. And largely as a result, I think, of the community and the connections. But what would you say to those who could on paper be sort of, could quite rightly say, well, I'm living with a permanent threat. It's not the tiger in the, you know, it's not the quick shock. It's actually, you know, if you're living with a diagnosis or you've been given a prognosis, but you really want to harness joy and find a way of living and find a way of diminishing the fear. How does one begin to regulate when that threat feels constant? I mean, you know, just putting it out there. I'm not sure if you, but you know, it's a big thing to manage. And I just wonder what your thoughts are.
I want to celebrate you on your journey, Emma, and appreciate how open and transformative your sharing of this journey, I imagine, is for so many in your community who don't maybe have the ability to embody the hope at whatever stage that they're on. And to kind of explore then, when we are threatened, as I think has been a theme throughout our entire conversation, what we are, why hope feels downright impossible for many. It is when our body is under threat. Now, I want to make a distinction here, right, between constant threat and how we navigate it, which is to say, right, that the thing, the diagnosis objectively might be chronic, you know, might be something that will go on for an unforeseeable future or indefinitely, depending on what it is. Though the question then, or the empowering shift we can make, right, is to not only tune into, okay, well, how is my body reacting, that awareness, creating then the space to give ourselves moments or begin the journey to give ourselves moments to regulate, even with the fear, right, being out there. Because the reality with emotions is, in addition to not only will two people with the same diagnosis have a different register in their body or experience of it, emotions in general aren't something that is just objectively mapped on from what is happening outside. It really is more of a byproduct, how we feel about something is more often the language we use, of many different things, beginning grounded in our past experience, the way we're making sense of, again, using this example, the diagnosis, how equipped our body is, because a resilient nervous system and a nervous system that we could create inside each of us is the ability to, I'm going to really simplify this, become stressed and then to calm down and then to become stressed and then to calm down. So creating the possibility through daily acts, and never is it more important to make sure, right, that there's physical self-care when you're dealing with a physical diagnosis in particular, that there's emotional self-care. I even think I heard you cite the power of community, right? And in your own journey to gain support, to hear, and this is why, again, I'm celebrating you and this beautiful community you've created, of being around other people who are living the same emotional experience, and so to feel less alone. And as we stay consistent, stability, let me add one more part in there, to allow ourselves to be supported, to ask for the help maybe that we physically need if we're going through treatment, to allow ourselves to be emotionally supported, to share what's on our mind and allow our emotions to be and go to the safe individuals who can just sit with us in our pain, not try to tell us to look at the bright side and it's going to be okay, just to join us in whatever it is that we're feeling, to feel that true level of emotional support or attunement. When we're consistently building from the body up those moments of possible groundedness, even if something out there is still constant, then it becomes possible to embody hope, to imagine the possibility that the future might look a little different than maybe what you're told it's inevitably going to look. Because again, hope is a function of our nervous system's ability to see hopefulness, to see possibility, to be in an embodied moment where we don't feel overwhelmed and debilitated with fear. So never again is it more important, as we were talking about in the beginning or a little bit earlier, to make sure that there's space in our lives, structurally, right? Changing things, asking for support, relying on people to help us in objective ways, finding the emotional supportive communities. Even if we do have well-meaning loved ones, not everyone knows how to show up. If they can't deal with their own selves and emotions, to then deal with the helplessness that they feel watching a loved one with a difficult diagnosis, suffering with symptoms or whatever it is, that might be what sends them into that look on the bright side mode, or maybe even worse for some of us, disconnection. I can't even be present to you in the way that I need, and I remove myself or create distance.
But that's the
magic. So having that support.
Yeah, and that's the magic of the time that we're in with, yes. You know, you've got your incredible self-healers community, you know, and that's it, isn't it? I think that the time that we're in, we are connecting virtually, mm-hmm. and having these, you know, virtually often, if we're lucky, spills over into a real physical kind mm-hmm. of face-to-face friendship. But it's absolutely, it blows my mind, the magic and the power of that, and how lucky we are with all the kind of the negative things we could say about the way the online space is. I think it's absolutely priceless, and I know I'm not alone in talking about in just feeling so held, you know, mm-hmm. and ultimately kind of healed in some way, whatever it is we're dealing with. I didn't want to go off on too much of a kind of health tangent and with our time together, but I just, one other, I'm using a kind of an example of, it could link to what I've just talked about in terms of health, but again, it comes under the umbrella of everything we're talking about. I'm really curious, and this is what makes us, some of us, able to be, so, you know, we can, many of us who have had a difficult time in certain areas will be, oh, you're so resilient. How do you do so well? And we seem to deal with these kind of life or death situations. Well, we deal with them because we have no choice, but we deal with them in a way. But then the dysregulation can come over something so tiny. So I notice in my own life, I will kind of face things, and I have come through things, and I live with things. My area of, and if I think of myself as a mother, or, you know, of dysregulation will be over something tiny. And I always, then you feel the shame, and then you go into self-abandonment, and what's wrong with me? And you know, I'm not sitting in a chemo chair. Why have I just completely, you know, lost my mind because I'm on holiday with the kids and the hire car won't start and I'm panicking and they're laughing at me and I want to cry, but you feel ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, so I'm wondering why we find, why is it the tiny things that often tip us when actually we're dealing and holding so much bigger stuff every day?
Acknowledging the shame that I think most of us feel in those reactive moments over seemingly small events, I want to offer the possibility, and then I'll obviously go into, as I always do, the physiology of why it is a probability that they're not actually small, those moments. That what's happening and why they come out in such an emotionally big way is because what's being touched is something much deeper. It's not really about, to use your example, the car not working. It's not really about the seemingly surface, simple, little thing of the car not working. It's about maybe perhaps the meaning.
Layers beneath, yeah.
That's being assigned to the car not working, what that means about you, the possibility in the moment, the future, what's going to happen in another moment, and then connect it with the meaning, as again, a theme throughout this entire conversation, physiologically, what that moment is bringing up, more accurately to say, where that moment has brought us to in the past. And likely, that meaning and that physiology is going to be mapped on to much earlier moment, if not many consistent moments in time, where we physiologically had an emotional experience, assigned a similar type meaning to whatever was happening or not happening in our environment, and were realistically, legitimately, objectively overwhelmed with underdeveloped or immature ways to cope with it. And then what we're reliving in our adulthood, which is why we feel so shameful, is that regressive experience of doing the exact same thing we did, say, in childhood, screaming and yelling when we were overwhelmed by whatever it was emotionally, right? Detaching and icing, not talking, being passive aggressive, running away, you know, fleeing, distracting, changing subject. And so understanding, again, the physiology for a lot of us, giving ourselves the gift of compassion in those moments, which I think is a byproduct. If I can understand, oh, the reason why this moment in the car was so big and I did the thing I did and now I feel shameful because I had a meltdown or I screamed and I said something or did something I didn't mean, or, you know, I removed myself emotionally from someone who needed me, whatever version of it that it was, I might be able to compassionately understand what was happening. I went back to a place where I was overwhelmed and I reacted habitually in the only way at one time that I could. And then again, those two steps, once I have that awareness, of course, many of us want to begin to break some of these, to give our body the ability to regulate and remain responsive in those moments. We can't just, that insight, again, does not just delete the narratives, remove the physiology from the body, therefore making the habitual pattern no longer necessary. That part is so important. We have to tune into our body as it's getting dysregulated, unhook our mind from the narrative that's causing or connect it, I should say, to the dysregulation and practicing new way of dealing with what's happening emotionally for us. Because if we don't, we will return very shamefully to those older reactive patterns.
And it's as we're talking this through, it makes me want to go back and give the me in that car park late at night in Spain, you know, I kind of want to go and mother that, right, that woman, right. Yes. As she was not mothering her own children very successfully, and because the layers of subtext, the historic, you know, that it's so obvious as you're talking, it's like, of course I could write 1,000 words on why that moment and what that moment meant. And I guess so then it's going forward, having, again, coming back to having the self-compassion. And if, when the next time we dysregulate, as I said to you just before we hit record, I've had a dysregulated moment, it's again just coming back and not, and it's the shame. And I think, so I'm really aware of our time and I could talk to you forever, but you know, I think this is the work. This is the work that so many of us are keen to do and ready to do, but we need guidance. We need your incredible voice, your incredible wisdom to believe that we can break those cycles. Because I think we've all kind of, we get to a point and we're conditioned to believe that actually this is us. This is who we are. This is how life is. This is how it's always been. This is how it's always going to be. And we can just entertain the possibility that actually, no, there is another way. And it's not going to be, it's going to be uncomfortable. But also it's the kind of moments of euphoria you feel when you do have those kind of epiphanies and realizations and insights. They're priceless, I feel.
Here's where I can offer a very practical two-part suggestion. First, just mapping onto the beautiful wisdom you're sharing, noticing those small moments of empowered shift. We so quickly diminish because we're not where we want to be, where we just had another shameful moment and now we diminish or minimize. Really embodying and celebrating and being present to all of the small shifts. And very practically, beginning this practice, not only consistently, as we've been talking about, through caring for our physical body, attuning to our emotions, creating ways that we can better manage through nervous system regulation and safe co-regulation with safe others. Beginning, right, to practice in moments outside of those big eruptive moments, because those aren't the first place that we're going to see change happen. We're going to begin to see change happen when we live consciously present to ourselves and we begin to notice small shifts in our body stress, right? Not as overwhelming narratives in our mind. And we make the choice to unhook the focus from a narrative that's unhelpful to help calm and regulate our body. It's not going to be in those moments with the deepest, most ingrained pattern and wounding that we really want to change, where change is going to happen first. So I say that in hopes of us not getting discouraged. I still have patterns, and I can even use this past couple of weeks as an example, as I've talked about, right? What is my core wound is being emotionally disconnected. I know for me, and this is another hopeful, shame-relieving piece of information for those listening, the more, again, coupling this all together, the more inconsistent I am in caring for my physical self, the more stress I'm under, which usually go hand in hand. When things to do pile up and that overachiever personality is at the ready, pushing my personal, my physical and emotional needs to the background and in favor of just showing up and plowing through, those, if that happens for too long, which I just spent, the book came out a little over 2 weeks ago from the day we're recording. With that, I had the incredible opportunity of some incredible press I was able to do, some in-person book events, all positive emotions, being in front of the community. I didn't have the opportunity when the first book came out, some traveling. I went back to actually two hometowns, New York City and LA, before I came home and did an event, with even excitement, because excitement physiologically is just like stress. Especially when it's not positive emotions and it's just hard stuff we're dealing with. And we're not caring for me that those are the moments where self-care goes to the back burner. Those are the moments where these old habitual patterns are so at the ready, come to the surface. And for me, upon arrival home, all I wanted, I had a weekend, 2 days, where all I wanted to do was be present with my partners. I really needed to just be cared for, be in their presence. I did a lot of service the week before. I went back right into that old pattern of myself where I would be passive aggressive. I would be mean. I would lock myself into the room and then wonder, validating, no one cares about me. No one wants to support me right now. How dare you not support me? Did you not just see what I did all week? Right back into those old reactive moments. So I'm sharing that in hopes of normalizing that slip, allowing any listeners who are seeing or living maybe in one of those reactive moments right now to gift themselves with that compassion. And again, to continue to emphasize those deep-rooted habits will be the last to change. Mine are still here, wired into me neurobiologically, at the ready, sometimes even being expressed outward. So the practice is so important to start in small ways, as you beautifully said, Emma, to celebrate the small moments of progress, not to take these moments of what feels like backsliding to be, you know, indicative of hopelessness, to take it as a part of our natural journey of creating change, especially when it's very difficult to do so.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that that experience and how it manifested itself. And I can, in a totally understandable way, I can almost feel that feeling of, the huge build up to the book coming out and all the commitments and the excitement and the adrenaline. And then I guess, going back, I almost wanted to say to you, what age were you when you kind of went into your bedroom and kind of, shut the door and thought, were you 6-year-old Nicole or 14-year-old Nicole? Because again, you'd be that very familiar feeling of the unmet needs, I guess.
My whole childhood, I feel like my whole childhood emotionally, even if I was physically present to the people, the caregivers, my mom and dad around me, my sister, I was emotionally in my bedroom with the shut door. So it was pervasive, Emma, for me across and beginning for as long as I can remember. And physiologically, I have memories of laying in bed, particularly at night, which is where I think a lot of our emotions when we don't, I was endlessly busy with after school activities and playing sports and, as a child. So, and in adulthood, I think during the day, our focus can be in all of these different places and it's at night. And so at night as a child, I remember this feeling of emotional loneliness for me feels like a pressure on my chest that almost gives it a feeling like there's a hole straight through. And I remember that from as young as I can remember, though, again, the pervasive feeling of being alone in my emotional bedroom was my entire early adulthood development in all of my relationships, not only in my family.
And yet that's the place you retreat to.
Yep.
Still now. Oh my goodness. Your wisdom is a gift to us all. The book, How to Be the Love You Seek, is just extraordinary. And I think for anyone on a path of personal growth, it's an incredible accompaniment to those of us who are striving to really live our lives with the awareness that we are the love that we seek. And I feel incredibly humbled and grateful that I'm just put my little toes onto that path of recognizing that maybe it's time for me to take up my space and really, love myself. And but I honestly, I'm so excited about being able to share this conversation. And I know that I speak for millions when I say that we're so grateful for the work you do and your wisdom. And I know that there'll be so much more to come. And thank you so much for today. Thank you, Nicole.
Oh, of course, Emma. It's been an honor. And again, I'm celebrating you, all of, especially the parents, though all of us who are in connection with other individuals as however point of our journey that we're sticking our toe in. What a gift to our relationships and to our shared world that this journey can be, because it saddens me, especially as I think parents, I'm not a parent myself, so I cannot fully relate to the experience. So I hear from a lot of parents, especially with adult children, right? This idea or concern as children age, that there's a lost hope. It's too late, right? Changing now won't do anything. Changing and transforming, beginning with our relationship with ourselves, and then showing up differently in a dynamic with whoever it is, our adult child, our teenage child, our little child, is so impactful, as is with our partners, our loved ones, our friends, the strangers we meet on the street. As I talk about in the book, the science behind being able to embody love and send those signals out will impact anyone that we come in contact with. So the gift, again, you and all of you, everyone listening, are giving not only yourselves, but the gift that keeps on giving, if you will, to humanity is so great, is so impactful. And I'm just so honored to be walking this journey alongside all of you.
I wish I could lean in and just, give you a hug. What a conversation. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wish you so much love in your life and so much. I'm sure that you feel the love coming from us. So thank you, Nicole.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of Open, hosted by me, Emma Campbell, and produced by Pretty Fire Audio Productions. It would mean so much if you would take a moment to like, review, and subscribe to the show. I'm loving having these conversations, and I really hope you're enjoying them too. So please join me for the next episode. And in the meantime, you can find me on Instagram at LimitlessM. Say hello. And if you'd like to join one of my regular online expressive writing workshops, where we use gentle prompts and timed exercises to let the words flow beautifully onto the page, then check out the schedule link in my Instagram bio or email me at emma@limitlessm.com for more info. See you soon.